From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, a one-man wrecking crew on the Texas-Mexico border who inspired hate, violence, corruption, and mass murder. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Violence, corruption, and a white supremacist agenda on the Texas-Mexico border. That was the state of things a century ago. There was a deliberate campaign to misinform the public that the border was lawless, dangerous, and a threat to national security. And this was done to justify the taking of land and political power from Mexican-American residents in South Texas. Orchestrating much of this was one man, William Hansen. He was an agent of chaos who actively spread misinformation about the border in order to create political opportunities for himself and his family to profit from. The story is told in the new book, William Hansen and the Texas-Mexico Border, Violence, Corruption, and the Making of the Gatekeeper State. The author is historian John Weber.
So he was someone who, as I was researching my dissertation, which eventually turned into my first book, his name just kept popping up. This place where you probably would most likely see him is if you're reading stuff about the Texas Rangers in the 19-teens. Between 1918 and 1919, he was a ranger captain and the first inspector of the Rangers. So that's probably why most historians or others would know who he is. But I also just kept seeing him other places, both in primary documents and in secondary literature. He was one of the people, as a deputy U.S. Marshal at the very beginning of the 20th century, he was one of the people chasing Gregorio Cortez. He then shows up in Mexico a few years later. And is one of the people trying to kind of really push foreign investment there. As it turns out, he's not terribly successful, even though he tries to pretend he is. He has his hands in farming and ranching and irrigation and oil, though he never seemed to be anything other than just someone's manager, right? The capital from the U.S. would flow in, he would manage it, but he didn't seem to actually make much money off of it. He then gets booted out of Mexico. And comes back to Texas right as the really ugly violence in the mid-teens starts up. And he always seems to sort of be floating there near these moments of rapid change, of overwhelming violence. I've referred to him at other times as a kind of evil Forrest Gump character who just constantly keeps popping up these moments. Again, just sort of randomly on the side. He's not the one creating these problems, but he always seems to be there when they pop up. So it was one of those things where I was doing my dissertation of the first book. He was just this sort of fascinating person who I didn't even know who the hell he was, what to do with him. And so I have a long footnote in the first book, and that's all I do. As I was actually doing the kind of revision process of dissertation into book, I was at the National Archives and randomly was looking through State Department records in College Park, Maryland. And I found a series of documents produced by State Department officials trying to stop these illegal deportations of Mexican exiles back to Mexico to be executed. They were people who had taken part in the De La Huerta rebellion in Mexico in 1923 and 1924. When that failed, they escaped to the United States. I found out that the person who was illegally deporting them was William Hansen, who was now one of the top officials of the Immigration Service, the District Director of Immigration for basically the San Antonio District, which covered all of South Texas. So I suddenly was like, oh, so this guy turns out was doing other things that I didn't know about. And, you know, kind of for the next few years, as I was getting that first book done, set it aside, but I was always kind of like, there seems like there's a bigger story here, right? Maybe I just write a journal article about this weird case of him illegally deporting people to be executed, right? What is, for all intents and purposes, a kidnapping and murder for hire scheme. Maybe I'll find something else, but right, once I get this first book done, I'm going to go back to this. And as I kept digging, I kept finding more of these illegal actions, right? More just astonishing levels of corruption at every point in his career. And so, you know, that was what I continued to sort of dig in for a few years until I, you know, basically found this 10 to 12 year period of his life where he maintains these fairly powerful positions, never as an elected official, always appointed, but as you said, largely in the background, and always seemingly with two objectives in mind. One was to push forward the political and economic goals of whoever it was that had hired him, whether it's the governor of Texas, whether it's Albert Bacon Fall, when he works for him for a while, or whether it's right whoever is pulling the strings for what it is the Immigration Service is doing. And to find ways to make illicit money, which in every one of these stops he very clearly was doing, even if I don't have, unfortunately, canceled checks or receipts to prove all of that. Very clearly, he was making money off the side of this, though, as it turns out, probably not very much because he dies a broken man, largely forgotten by the people who he had helped during his career.
So he's a fascinating character. You say he's like an evil Forrest Gump, but in Forrest Gump, he just shows up at these random locations when history's happening. But it does seem that to William Hansen, either he was causing these atrocities to happen, or he was attracted to them and pursued them.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah. So, again, in a lot of ways, I don't think he was the author of many of these policies, right? He's not the one who introduces, racial violence to the Texas Rangers. He's not the one who introduces, shilling for oil companies to the U.S. government, which is one of the things he spends a number of years doing when he's working for Albert Bacon Fall. He's not the one who introduces racial profiling or, corruption to immigration control. But I sort of argue he not only gives us a window into how those things happen, but there's also a kind of both remarkable continuity of his actions throughout these different moments in his career. But also, again, I think we see here some of the consequences of the way in which immigration control, law enforcement, racialized law enforcement, the expansion of US empire end up really kind of accumulating at this enormously important moment in the teens and 20s, when you really see the US state starting to expand in kind of uneven but really important ways. And Hansen manages to sort of put himself at the service of those forces throughout this period.
There's a lot to talk about, but it does seem like Hansen was very much always looking for ways to destabilize Mexico. And we're talking in the decades of the 1910s to the 20s, on maybe into the 30s. He was expelled from Mexico as being a counter-revolutionary. So how did he not get executed for that?
So again, he's you're absolutely right. So in 1914, he is arrested as a counter-revolutionary by Carrancista forces. So, sort of revolutionary forces.
Right, and set to see 1914 is when the United States invades Tampico, I mean Veracruz and all.
So this is immediately before that. So this is early 1914. He gets arrested as a counter-revolutionary. The governor of Tamaulipas is, or sort of officials in Tamaulipas are, have decided they're going to execute him as a counter-revolutionary. The U.S. consul in Tampico manages to step in just beforehand and convinces them to just deport him, right? Don't kill him, just deport him, and make him promise he'll never come back. So he manages to avoid execution. He goes back to Texas, but then almost immediately goes back to Tampico. And it's in that second, and again, I have no idea why he went, how he thought this was going to work out. When he's in Tampico, you then have the violent incident between US sailors and Mexican law enforcement that ends up leading then days later to the US invasion of Veracruz. So Hansen is just sort of randomly there in Tampico when this happens.
Did he have any way to influence President Wilson at all? I mean, President Wilson obviously invaded Mexico twice during his presidency. It looked like that the United States was going to have a full-out invasion into Mexico. We had so much of U.S. military stationed along the U.S.-Mexico border preparing to invade. What was his role in all that?
So not much. This is one of the very odd kind of side parts of Hansen's story. He is a Republican, which again, in early 20th century South Texas was kind of a strange thing to choose to beat, right? The Republican Party was essentially non-functional right up until essentially the 1960s.
And that's because of the still resentment over the Civil War
Yeah, this is
and
still very much, right,
Reconstruction.
the kind of post-Reconstruction, right? The Republicans are the party of Lincoln, therefore, right, Republicans are not considered legitimate parts of right Southern governance. He is a Republican, so he's one of these people who's constantly sort of criticizing Wilson and throughout 1914, even though again it was a U.S. consul who ends up sort of keeping him from being executed. Hansen is constantly sort of assaulting verbally the Wilson administration for not being aggressive enough, right? Yes, they launched an attack on Veracruz, and obviously there will be the Pershing's expedition that'll come a few years later, chasing Pancho Villa. But for Hansen and the people around him, that was never enough, right? These were just sort of small scale problems that weren't dealing with what for them was the bigger problem, which is Carranza, the revolutionaries, need to be absolutely eradicated. So that was what Hansen throughout this period was really sort of demanding. And he continued to sort of bash the Wilson administration for not doing enough, right? Two invasions were not for William Hansen and for his eventual kind of patron, Albert Bacon Fall, nearly enough to deal with what they argued was the existential problem that was being created by the revolution in Mexico.
The chaos on our doorstep way of looking at things.
Yeah, exactly. That sort of trope that has never gone away.
William Hansen, I mean, he made his bones originally in Tamaulipas, which is the state that is borders Texas, through petroleum. He was working in the oil industry, right?
So he had, and this is one of the things that I have a hard time really kind of getting at. So he had connections to, and he claimed to be managing two oil companies in Tamaulipas, one of which was in a subsidiary of the Texas Company, right, which was one of the largest oil companies on earth. But I have very little evidence that he had no expertise in oil. He knew nothing about it. I have very little evidence that he actually made any money off of it because he was broke when he makes it back to the United States in 1914. So I think he was just a kind of convenient front man for these companies to sort of have there as their manager, right? He was someone who, right, he lives there, so we can sort of pretend he's the one who's operating things. I've never really seen much evidence that he actually did much. He certainly was connected to the oil companies, and he would spend, right, much of his career doing everything he could to aid them politically. Whether legally or not. But I don't really sort of have, I've never seen much evidence that he actually had a whole lot of impact or kind of day-to-day importance in running these companies, even if he claimed to be the manager of these two different oil companies.
So was William Hansen a fabulist? You would hang out at the Buckhorn Saloon and just spin these yarns about his time in Mexico and try to get Easterners to support his next ill-fated adventure.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of describing him. He was someone who had built his sort of hope for future, the future of his family, around the idea that they were going to be major capitalist powers in Mexico, right? That he was going to own ranches, he was going to operate irrigation companies, he was going to be involved in oil. Everyone in his family came down with him. His sons were educated, at least his youngest sons were educated towards those goals. One of them was a medical doctor, and the idea was he would be the primary doctor for an American colony that would develop around, right, what Hansen was doing. His youngest son went to Texas A&M, or what would become Texas A&M, to study agricultural science, and he was going to be, right, the kind of agronomist that then pushed forward their kind of agricultural operations over the years. So absolutely, right. He very much considered himself to be someone whose future was in Mexico. And when that collapses, he then spends the next, basically the rest of his life, simultaneously pretending that he had been more important there than he was, but also constantly looking for revenge, right? Some way to make the people pay. The people who he deemed responsible for his downfall, make them pay for what they had done to him. And I kind of argue throughout the book that that was, you can see through much of this, the time period, that was what drove so much of what he did.
The time 1910 to 1920 is a time described as the bandit wars, the border wars. What was he, how was he involved in that? And there was the plan, the San Diego. Can you explain what that is? It seemed like there was a deliberate attempt to create this atmosphere of a propaganda that the border was this extremely dangerous place.
So the plan of San Diego, which is really in a lot of ways the kind of the thing that really kind of accelerates the violence here, was a manifesto that was discovered by U.S. law enforcement in early 1915 that announced a date in the coming months at which a race war would begin. All Anglos under the age of 16, or over the age of 16, excuse me, were to be executed. And Texas, and presumably the entire rest of the US Southwest, would be essentially broken off from the United States and eventually, presumably, reattached to Mexico. The person who this sort of document is found on is arrested. He ends up going through trial. And by the time he goes through trial a couple of months later, no violence has actually broken out. And so the judge basically releases him, saying this person is just a crazy person, obviously, who cares? Though that summer, 1915, some raids start to begin going from northern Mexico into South Texas. And those raids are then met by massive counterattacks by the Texas Rangers, local law enforcement, bands of vigilantes that essentially, at times, are seemingly trying to depopulate parts of South Texas. There's violence coming from these raids coming from the south, but overwhelming violence then sweeping south into South Texas from, again, the Rangers, who at times seem to be operating as a kind of random assassination group, right? They're just going around South Texas. They find someone, they kill them. A number of books, Ben Jonson's Revolution in Texas, Munoz Martinez's The Injustice Never Leaves You have sort of dealt with this in really kind of compelling ways over the last several years.
And so basically they assumed anyone that they would see was who was a Mexican American, they would basically lynch them on sight.
Yeah, absolutely. So there's, again, the death tolls we don't really know for, I think, obvious reasons, but I think most estimates have it at the very least in the low thousands, if not, into the 3 to 5,000 range. We don't really know, but there were very clearly large numbers of people who just were massacred.
So what was William Hansen's involvement with the Texas Rangers at this point?
So in 1915, 1916, I honestly, and I kind of read about this in the book, I don't really know where he is. He pops up at a couple of moments. In particular, there's an infamous case where two men, Morin and Ponce, they are arrested by Rangers, and for some reason they are taken out of a jail at night, and taken back, supposedly being taken down to Brownsville. And some point in the middle of the night, while they're being taken, the Rangers claim somebody kidnapped them from us and probably killed them. We have no idea what happened. Right, this seems like just a clear case of these two guys were just executed somewhere in the back country, and the Rangers came up with the lamest excuse they could for what had actually happened. William Hansen was one of the people who supposedly arrested those two guys. Hansen himself would claim this later, at least. And he was not a law enforcement officer. He had no legitimate means or reasons for arresting someone. So I don't know exactly what he was doing. About the only thing I've been able to figure out was Morin was supposed by Hansen to be an agent of Carranza. So he seemed to have been following him around. And so Hansen seems to have, at that point, been basically working with the Texas Rangers and some other law enforcement agencies to track these guys. And for some reason, decided at this moment they needed to be arrested. But this was one of, right, what comes to be known as these just sort of cases of rangering, or rinchadas, right, where people are captured, and rather than actually being right pushed through the justice system, they just get randomly killed with some sort of vague justification for why it was the Rangers needed to kill them.
Okay, so another simultaneous development happening at this time is the expansion of the railroad into the Rio Grande Valley and other parts of this area. How did that change things?
So in a lot of ways that completely, and in a lot of ways, I think that in some ways the importance of that goes back even before, right, the enormous violence of the mid-teens. Right in the early 20th century, you for the first time have rail links directly to Brownsville. Right before then, right, the railroad reaches San Antonio in the 70s. It reaches Corpus and Laredo in the 80s. And so you're having more and more of South Texas being kind of dragged into the international market. In ways that it hadn't been before, right? It had been largely a kind of ranching territory before. Suddenly now in the early 20th century, rail links, outside capital, right? The capacity for irrigation works suddenly come, and that completely remakes the region, right? It suddenly goes from a place where you have this incredibly land extensive practices and labor extensive practices of ranching being replaced by the land and labor intensive practices of agriculture. That ends up changing the economic reality. It ends up meaning huge numbers of people start rushing in to try and buy up land as land values skyrocket and as right agriculture becomes something that's possible. And you start to see the Mexican and Mexican American majority being pushed out, many of them having their lands directly stolen from them. But you also see the political reality changing, right? The ranching sort of era was largely defined by these political machines, right? With Jim Wells and in Cameron County being the kind of the archetype. But almost all of South Texas counties had these sort of aligned political machines that were built on, right, sort of appealing to the Mexican American majority at election time, but also, right, when they needed to, being kind of violent and then sort of coercive. What happens when you have this change to agriculture is suddenly new coming farm interests have no interest in the old political machines, have no interest in appealing to the Mexican American majority. Their argument is we need to eliminate Mexican voting. We need to eliminate Mexican American voting. We need to essentially create a society that looks like, politically at least, a kind of carbon copy of what's in the South, where we have land ownership, political ownership, completely in the hands of Anglos. And we then have a laboring class that has no voting power that is defined by race, right? In South Texas, Mexicans and Mexican Americans, right? In the Southeast, obviously African Americans. So in many ways, right, what you see as, right, the railroads enter, you see this really rapid, incredibly tumultuous shift of economic systems, of political systems, that again, in many ways, is what then accelerates and catalyzes so much of that violence that then hits in the middle of the 19 teens. As, of course, it's worth noting, the Mexican Revolution is going on just to the south, which is not only sort of helping to destabilize, but also sending massive numbers of migrants into South Texas throughout this period.
So when you have this effort to, we need this land, we're going to take this land, they don't want to sell the land, so we're going to send in the muscle. The muscle would be the Texas Rangers.
In a lot of cases, yeah. Again, local law enforcement certainly at times operated along these same lines. But in many ways, right, the Texas Rangers make a pretty notable U-turn in the late 19-teens in particular, right? For years, right, Jim Wells, the machine politicians in South Texas, had a very friendly relationship with the Texas Rangers. Suddenly, in the late 19-teens, and I kind of write about this a lot in the kind of chapter on Hansen's time in the Texas Rangers. He is part of a kind of effort by political elites in sort of Austin to basically favor the newcomer farming interests, right? Not the old kind of machine politicians, not the kind of political structures that they built, but an entirely new, right, entirely white group of newcomers who are coming in and trying to build up as rapidly as possible this kind of agricultural empire in South Texas. And so the Texas Rangers flip very quickly. And so what happens in the 1918 election, or at least in the Democratic primary, is the Texas Rangers, who are at that point largely under the control of William Hansen, are sent out to polling places all over South Texas as an incredibly unsubtle threat, right? If large numbers of Mexican Americans show up and vote, understand the Texas Rangers are here, and we will do whatever we have to do to make sure that our guy wins.
To make sure you vote right.
Yeah, or more importantly, don't vote at all, right? If you don't want to run into the Texas Rangers, which again, right, for a lot of Mexican Americans in South Texas, they have very clear memories of what the Rangers had done 3 years earlier, right, in leading what was essentially a program of ethnic cleansing. So right, when the Rangers show up, that is not a subtle threat, right? That is very much a right, and started spreading rumors that if you can't speak English, you will be arrested for trying to vote, which of course is nonsense, but right, it sort of served its purpose. Voter turnout throughout South Texas plummeted.
I mean, what was he like as an individual? Do you know?
I don't really know. And this is one of the things I kind of struggled with in kind of putting this book together. I don't know anything about his personal life. All of the documents I have are right, are kind of professional correspondent. Only a couple of times do I have him kind of off guard moments where he is sort of talking personally about right, sort of family or stuff like that. But I have two, three documents like that, as opposed to the thousands of things I have of him, you know, that he's sort of produced, where it's entirely just about right, what it is he's sort of doing for whoever it is he's working for. He's clearly an astonishingly cynical man. He is someone who is willing to sort of sell himself and his sort of labor to whoever the highest bidder was. He largely is, right, a person who survives and at times does well for himself entirely through political patronage.
But it seems like he made a lot of enemies, and the enemies remembered him with a lot of spite. And there are some people who are rascals and scoundrels and are able to get away with it. He must have been thoroughly dislikable because his enemies continued to hound him throughout his life.
No, you're absolutely right. There are a number of people who he worked with in the Texas Rangers in particular who continued to despise him for years, who continued to sort of testify against him, or who, you know, at times would discover some of the highly illegal things he was doing and report it to, right, the Bureau of Investigation or other law enforcement agencies. So no, I think you're right, right? He clearly. And whether that was because he was a prickly individual, whether it was because he was just so astonishingly cynical in everything he did, I don't really know. But you're absolutely right. A lot of people who he worked with eventually turn on him, right, after he sort of moved on to some other position. In particular, people who he'd worked with in Texas Rangers, Frank Hamer, for instance, right, a kind of legendary Texas Ranger, despised Hansen, absolutely hated him. And would for the rest of Hansen's life, any time anyone wanted to hear something bad about Hansen, they just needed to go to Hamer and he would just unload.
John Weber is a San Antonio native and now professor of history at Old Dominion University in Norfolk, Virginia. His new book is William Hansen and the Texas-Mexico Border: Violence, Corruption, and the Making of the Gatekeeper State. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past episodes of Texas Matters on our website at tpr.org. And you can find us wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.